This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. My guest Clive Owen is starring in two movies on opposite ends of the commercial spectrum, the spectacle King Arthur and the independent film noir I'll Sleep When I'm Dead. The British actor made his American breakthrough starring in the independent film Croupier. Owen played a novelist leading a double life as a blackjack dealer in a casino. Owen has reunited with the director of Croupier, Mike Hodges, to make I'll Sleep When I'm Dead. Their new film has echoes of Hodges' now classic 1969 revenge film Get Carter, which starred Michael Caine. But although I'll Sleep When I'm Dead is also about revenge, it's not about a violent rampage like Get Carter. Clive Owen plays a gangster who has left the violent life. In order to keep away from that life and his own violent impulses, he's become a hermit, living in his van outside of the city. But when his brother Davy, a small-time drug dealer, is murdered, Owen wants revenge. Here he is, slipping back into the city, talking to his former lover, played by Charlotte Rampling.
Look at me. Look at what I've become. I sometimes don't talk to another living soul for f***ing days. Weeks. I'm always on the move. I trust no one, nothing. And it's got f*** all to do with escape. Or withdraw, fear. It's grief. For a life wasted. And now there's Davy. Another f***ing wasted life. And I'm going to find out why.
I asked Clive Owen if he and director Mike Hodges talked about the nature of the violence in the film.
The only really clear, strong discussion I can remember is whether at any point we see Will Graham actually show that violence, of whether the lid comes off and we see what he's capable of. I remember there was a scene in Croupier, and I remember feeling very strongly there's a fight scene in Croupier where somebody goes to fight him and the character gets into a fight, and because it was a similar character in terms of keeping the lid on, I was very clear and that I wanted to let the lid off just that once, show what was underneath this guy and then put it back on again so everybody could see what he was capable of. So we had discussions about whether we should do a similar thing with Will Graham, about whether we should suddenly see the violence that is within him and the violence that people are talking about having seen in him. But we decided in the end that it would be sort of tighter and tauter and more tense if we didn't actually release it throughout the whole movie.
You're kind of emotionally dead in the movie. And so you're not registering a whole big wide range of emotion, fear, anger, joy, laughter. Laughter isn't in the picture for you.
It's not.
So how does that affect what you can use?
It's strange because it's actually it was quite a deceptive script because it was very lean and it read as being pretty straightforward. But when I actually came to start playing the part, you realise that you can't just do nothing. You can't breeze those situations. Just because the character isn't saying very much, you still have to be very full up of emotion. He's a very emotional character. It's just that there's a lid on it all the time and there isn't much dialogue to use. So really it was a case of sort of filling up and then putting the lid on, and that was deceptively hard. I remember when I first started, I remember thinking it's much harder the work than I thought it was going to be.
There's a lot that we don't know about the characters in the film. There's a lot we don't really know about your character, including exactly what happened that required him to leave the city and separate from his past so that he could disassociate from his violent past. Did you feel that you needed to know more than the audience knows about your past so that you could really inhabit the character?
I always find that I need to know what I'm talking about. If there's a direct relation to what I'm saying or what other people are saying, then I need to have the information there. But I often don't need more than that. I'm not the sort of actor who feels the need to go off and research whole worlds. You hear of actors, they play a doctor, they'll go and live as a doctor, they'll talk to doctors, they'll immerse themselves in that world. I tend to be more instinctive than that. I think ultimately, the bottom line is you watch a movie and you believe the person. The person says the lines, you believe them or not. And my thing in this movie was really, as long as I knew anything that anybody talked about my character or that I said, I was fine with that. I didn't need to ultimately, all you're doing is, you're capturing the scenes, and that's, I felt I did what was necessary and no more really.
My guest is Clive Owen, and he's starring in the new movie I'll Sleep When I'm Dead, which is directed by Mike Hodges, who also directed Owen in the movie Croupier. I want to ask you about Croupier. This is such a terrific film, and in this you play a writer who takes a job as a croupier running a blackjack table in a casino. And let me just play a short scene from the film. The film has a lot of voiceover narration from your character, and he's usually talking about himself, both as himself, Jack, and as Jake, the main character in his novel. Let me play some voiceover narration from your character toward the end of the film. He's at the blackjack table.
Chapter 10.
He watched their faces as they lost, hour after hour, night after night, relentlessly. He questioned the conventional wisdom that gamblers are self-destructive. He had come to believe that in reality they want to destroy everyone else. Their families, loved ones, everyone. Over the whole world. Without emotion, he watched them go. Jake stayed.
That's Clive Owen as the croupier in the film The Croupier. This is a really such a great film in part about the meaning of risk. Like what kind of risk is worth taking? When are you being a sucker? What are some of the things you did to get into the spirit of this film? You know, in which you're not a gambler. Your character is not a gambler. He's opposed
to
gambling.
Against gambling. Yeah.
Yeah, but he takes a lot of big gambles that just aren't in the casino. But anyways, so he takes this job at the casino as a croupier at the blackjack table. What's some of the preparation you had to do for this, even in terms of just like learning how to deal?
I actually went to croupier school for a couple of weeks and actually trained with the guys that were teaching there. Literally just slotted in and did it properly for 2 weeks, which was a real insider's look at the way casinos work, really, because I was taught as they were taught. We were taken around the casino. We were forbidden to gamble because all croupiers are. And I remember the thing that struck me more than anything was it's one of the few environments where there's still a lot of cash casinos, which is unusual in this day and age to have so much cash flying around. So ultimately, they are obsessed about not being ripped off. So when they're teaching croupiers, they drill into them every single day, do not think you'll ever be able to take a penny from this casino. We've got everything covered. You'll never get away with it. And I remember thinking that sort of slight paranoia was really striking. And it is related to the fact that, you know, you're handling money all the time. It's not credit. It's, you know, and there are stories of people having developed scams, croupiers developing scams. They don't tell you this. You hear it from other places of scams of how to actually, you know, get money and take it from the casino. And then I remember the other really important thing we discovered very early on in the movie is often with voiceover, you'll play the scene and Michael shoot the whole movie and then the voiceover is laid on afterwards. You put the voiceover on. And there was on the first or second day, I was at a blackjack table and I was just generally doing some dealing. And Mike said, yeah, we'll lay some voiceover over that. And it concerned me a bit. And I went round to see him in his hotel room later. I said, I'm a bit concerned about this because it feels very unspecific to lay the voiceover just over general dealing. And I said, I think it needs to be more specific than that because often the voiceover is in the present tense. It just didn't feel tight. So we came up with this plan where I would go off and learn all the voiceovers. And then when we actually came to shoot them, I would speak them out loud. And then we would do a take where I just thought them. So there'd be people there, there'd be extras there. And the thoughts were very, very specific. So if I thought about a particular character or a person that was at my table, I could flick them a look. I could... And it worked very well. It didn't mean to say that Mike had to use all of that, because obviously he can cut away, he wants to do whatever he wants to do, but the times where he did use it, it made the voiceover very... You felt like you were inside the guy's head. It made it very, very present. And I remember that was a key discovery that we made together early on in the movie.
My guest is actor Clive Owen. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Clive Owen. He's starring in two new films, the epic King Arthur and the independent film noir I'll Sleep When I'm Dead. He starred in the film Croupier, and he made a series of action shorts created as ads for BMW and shown on the internet. Each starred Owen at the wheel of a BMW driving a high-risk passenger. The shorts were directed by such luminaries as John Woo and John Frankenheimer. I asked Owen how he got the part.
It was really through Croupier. Croupier had just sort of made its impact in America, and then I got this call saying, did I want to do a series of commercials for BMW? And I said, no, I didn't, because I was meeting, things seemed to be opening up a bit. I was meeting lots of interesting people, and I thought it wouldn't be a very smart, cool thing to do to just jump into a bunch of commercials, because I didn't really know that much about them. And they came back and asked again, and I said, no, I really don't want to do commercials. I don't want to do this. And then right at the wire, they sent me the script of the first one, which was this 10-minute, proper, fully-formed little movie script, very well written. They said, we've secured John Frankenheimer and Ang Lee to do the first two. And I suddenly thought, this project is really unusual. It's very different, and it's, you know, they're attracting serious quality people. So I literally jumped on a plane the next morning, arrived in LA, and was taken straight from the airport to a night shoot with John Frankenheimer to shoot the first one. And I'm just enormously grateful that it didn't pass me by, because, as you say, I ended up working with some of the world's top directors, and it was a very exciting project. To work with that caliber of director was really exciting.
So what are some of the differences between how, say, John Frankenheimer and John Woo directed you behind the steering wheel?
Yeah, I remember that the very first one, that Frankenheimer is regarded as the king of the car chases, and he took, his really is one long car chase, and he showed me examples of actors driving fast in movies and examples of people that did it well and people who didn't do well and why they did, and he had the whole thing down to absolutely every cut of the chase. So he knew when he was going from steering wheel to rearview mirror to road to, and was incredibly specific and knew down to literally like 3-second shot. Like, this is a bit you're just going to just pull the wheel this way. Just literally 2-3 seconds and he'd be out of it. But he was that specific, and you realise that's why he's so great at doing car chases, because, you know, he puts that much attention to it.
I'll remind our listeners that John Frankenheimer, among other things, directed French Connection 2. So when he was showing you examples of good and bad acting behind the steering wheel, what were some of the things he pointed out?
It was really just to do with whether they looked like they were really driving fast. They looked in the situation. And some people didn't. When you watched them, you thought, they're not connected with the speed of the car, with everything else, and other people looked very much in the situation. I really just looked at it, and it was, you know, the same acting principles apply. There was nothing particular about it. It was just, you've got to really make people feel and believe that you're in this dangerous, you know, high-speed car chase. I think he was the one that invented the whole notion of, which I did a lot of, because a lot of people said, did you do a lot of the driving yourself? But what they used to do is they used to rip the steering out, put it on the other side, place a stuntman driving the car, give me a dummy wheel, and as long as you frame out the guy sitting next to me, they can throw that car around and drive it pretty fast with me actually in it, so you can see the world racing by outside the window. And I did quite a lot of that, and I think it was John that was the first guy to do that.
What did John Woo, what kind of advice did he give you?
I mean, he was, I can't remember anything, you know, specific John Woo said, but I was a big fan of John Woo, and he's, you know, brilliant at putting together action, and there's a sequence in his one that was pretty, you know, one of the more stunning car sequences of the whole series, really. But
Is that the one where the car's spinning around a lot?
Yeah, and there's a bridge being slowly going up, and there's a car, you know, there's a whole sequence where the car eventually just spins to a stop, and the wheel literally is on the edge of this very high bridge. It's a pretty stunning car stunt.
And were you in the car for that stunt?
No. They took the stunt guy got as close as he could do, then they would replace the car with the wheel on the edge and then put me in it.
We've established that your face registers a lot in films. In the BMW films, basically, it's mostly you behind the driver's wheel, and your face has to express a lot. In Croupier, your face has to express a lot, certainly in I'll Sleep When I'm Dead. What was it like the first time you saw your face on screen?
It's very strange. I wouldn't say that that was the strangest thing, because you're used to seeing photographs of yourself. The strangest thing is seeing the whole of you, really. The first time you see yourself on TV or on film, walking down a street or turning around, it's the perspectives that we don't get that is the most unusual thing. Oh my gosh, I walk like that, I look like that from that angle. That's the sort of oddest thing, to see yourself that objectively. It's a very unusual experience.
Were there things you tried to fix or change about yourself after seeing your full body from every perspective?
It's strange, though, because I'm sort of wary. There are always people going to be advising you that certain aspects of yourself, the way you talk, the way you carry yourself, could be better. You know, your posture could be better. Your voice could be better. It could be clearer. And I'm always a bit wary, because I think ultimately acting is about, you know, you can't be too contrived. You can't be worrying about things like that. Ultimately, you've got to. It is an emotional job that demands a commitment. Of course, there's always an element of skill, and you know, you learn and improve and get better. It is a craft, but I'm wary of too much of it. So I am, in a similar way, I'm wary of changing things that other people think would be better. You know, I'm 6'2", but I don't often stand up very tall, but I'm comfortable in the way I carry myself. And I, you know, suddenly if I start, you know, standing up much straighter, and it just feels different. It feels less like me, and I feel I'm becoming something else, and I'm wary of that.
When you first started on the BBC in England and you did your first series, which was called...
There was a series I did called Second Sight, but that wasn't really where I started. I'd done a lot of work before then. The first sort of big TV series was a series called Chancer, which was a series on ITV in the UK way back when. It was like, you know, 13 years ago.
Now, I read that after that series, or maybe during that series, as you were becoming really popular, the tabloids started to move in on you. What was it like to, you know, suddenly, when you were still like pretty young, have this kind of scrutiny?
I found it very unsettling. I found it, you know, I went into this TV series, you don't really know what to expect. You're a very young guy, and suddenly when the series explodes and becomes this big primetime TV success, the tabloids get very interested. The tabloids love television. They love, you know, actors in television. And I was pretty naive, and they'd throw all the tabloid newspapers at me into my trailer to talk to, and I thought, you know, you'd probably have to talk to everybody, and I'd talk, and then you'd get these sort of really tacky stories. I mean, nothing too vicious, but just, it was all just unsettling and felt sort of ugly, and I found it very difficult. I was really sort of quite resentful of it. I was very young and I didn't quite know how to deal with it. So when it came to this, I did the second series of this show, an older actor said to me, you know, you can say no. So I did, and I said, I'm not talking to the press. And then I got this obvious reputation for being difficult with the press, because I just, you know, avoided them and didn't talk to them all during the second series. And then I did one big press conference at the end of it to get some press out of the way. And people said, why have you not talked to us for a year or whatever? And I said, and I explained my reasons, that I find it difficult. You know, then every tabloid was full of Clive Owen, the price of fame, Clive Owen shuns fame, the difficulty of being a TV star. And it was horrendous again. It was like, I couldn't win.
I know one of the things one of the tabloids did was track down your birth father, who had left the family, I think, when you were three. Let me just stop here and ask you if this is something I can ask about, or whether you just...
It depends what you ask.
Okay. Well, if it's a problem, you just tell me.
Okay.
Had you already met him before the tabloid tracked him down?
It was very difficult for me, because my father had left the home, and I did this TV series, and actually the character I was playing was somebody who was estranged from their father, and I was just very wary and cautious that the tabloids would love this as a story, you know, the parallels of my character and the fact that I myself, you know, was estranged from my father. So I was very wary, and that's probably another reason why I found it so difficult with the tabloid newspapers, because there was something I was hiding, there was something I was protecting, and they smell that, I think. I think they start talking about personal things and you look uncomfortable, and they're very experienced in honing in on the areas that people obviously hiding something or aware of, and that was it for me. And eventually it all came out in the tabloids about my father, and it wasn't that big a deal. And eventually it was quite freeing up for me, because then there was nothing I had to protect. I didn't, you know, I wasn't feeling that I had to be as careful around that area. And in a way, it coming out in the tabloids was probably a good thing. It sort of opened it up.
Were you trying to protect yourself or your father?
I didn't want that parallel of somebody's, you know, my personal, nobody wants their personal life in that way put out in the tabloids. There are, and to a certain extent, you know, as I've got older and married and got children, there are certain areas of my life that I don't think are for public consumption. And I think, you know, I'll talk about the work, I'll you know, to talk about my career, but the very personal private stuff that matters is, I just don't understand the impulse to share that with newspapers or journalists in any way.
Well, Clive Owen, thank you so much for talking with us.
Thank you.
Clive Owen is starring in King Arthur and I'll Sleep When I'm Dead. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.